I will also talk about what motivated the founding fathers to write the Constitution in 1787. Okay, I'm also going to give you a couple of historical interpretations, and we will, as a matter of fact, be going through the historical process during this lecture. So as we do this, we're going to make some generalizations, and from these established generalizations, we're going to make a hypothesis. So we're going to go through the process, and we're going to take a look at why these men, and yes, they were all men, okay, from 12 states, we'll talk about that, 12, Rhode Island wasn't a part of this, ranging in age from 25 to 81, spent a long, hot summer creating the Constitution. So, as we take a look at the introduction to this lecture, we can look at the famous English Prime Minister, William Gladstone. And think on his words, what he said of the Constitution, he said, quote, "It was the most wonderful work ever put forth by the brains of man." Okay. This document must have been pretty good, because it's still with us today, right? But the big question is, was it necessary? Did we really need it? And was it a product of the majority? Was it really we, the people? So when we look at the Constitution of 1787, it's estimated that only 4-5% really got to vote on it. Whether or not they approved, that's something different. But probably, the average guy on the street, Joe Farmer, would have voted against it. But he never really got the chance. This is the key difference between what we have, the system we have today, and what they have then in the voting process. Let's take a look at what preceded the writing of the Constitution. So as you know, the Articles of Confederation, they represented the first constitutional agreement made between the 13 American states. So the Articles were in effect from 1781 to 1789, realizing, of course, that it was in 1789 that the Constitution was finally ratified. So now to understand a law and why it's passed, you need to understand what happens before the law is passed. Okay, so we're going to look at the circumstances by which the Constitution of 1787 came into effect. Some historians have called this the critical period of American history. John Fiske, F-I-S-K-E, John Fiske, he's the one, he was a turn-of-the-century historian, and turn-of-the-century 19th to 20th century. He's the one who more or less popularized this term. So if this looked at the time period and the events of things like Shays' Rebellion, things that were going on, the Rhode Island legislature was going crazy, they were printing all this money, wanting to loan money out as an illegal tender. We'll see problems with the British in the Northwest. Certain people are being hurt by lack of commercial trade controls. There's no uniform tariff. And we actually have states that are taxing each other's goods, and that's preventing goods from flowing from state to state. Virginia is seizing boats on the Potomac River for not paying a duty to pass by Virginia shoreline. Okay? In addition, 9 of the states have their own navy. So 9 different navies are on here. So certain men of property are going to find that the new government is not working. They're going to see that they're having problems here with this new government. Okay? People holding continental securities and savings bonds, okay, they're not going to be getting their interest payments. Creditors are being hurt by inflation. And the currency issue was a large problem. So this is why Fiske called this the critical period. There were problems without a doubt. Okay? The big question is, how critical was it? Okay? This is something that will be open to interpretation. So under the Articles of Confederation, we had a unicameral, weak government. It consisted of 13 equals. Okay, we have our 13 equals here. 13 equals. The system required a unanimous decision to pass amendments or to change it, you know, or to conduct. And to conduct normal business, it took a 2/3 majority vote. Okay? This can be difficult to obtain. We all know, if you think about what happened here with this past year with the California state budget, here in California, we require the 2/3 majority to pass the budget. Well, when you add things in, you add different factions and different partisans into the mix, it makes obtaining this 2/3 majority versus the, you know, simple majority much more difficult to have happen, thus the delay with our budget. Okay? What we end up with government where there isn't any real power. Okay? Alexander Hamilton said it, and said it best when he said, "The Articles had neither the sword nor the purse," referring, of course, to power and money. Okay. So looking at this weak government, we need to understand that we couldn't pay our bills. Okay? We couldn't protect private property or advance commerce. And this is the government that we have from 1781 to 1789. So this government, it wasn't a very strong government, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, okay? Remember, we were coming out of depression in 1787. Things were beginning to prosper more for people. I would make the claim that the average person, the average Joe Farmer person, was fairly happy. I mean, really, the majority of American people, okay, the majority of the people, we know that they weren't sitting around, you know, the Starbucks, the coffee houses, whatever, their peats, and having their Fufu, decaf, half-calf, no-calf, sugar-free, vanilla, whatever, latte things that they were having. They're not going to be holding their coffee, sitting around discussing law, and saying things like, I think this week we should take a look at our Confederation and, you know, change that and set up a constitution. They're not doing it. The average person is not doing that. However, let's point out that there were some political, economic, and diplomatic problems happening. So just to recap, the government is having problems establishing order, okay, on the frontier. This is going to hurt land speculators, okay? They can't control commerce. There's no control of commerce going on, and there's currency problems that in addition are causing some tension. Okay? Now, are these unsolvable problems? You know, could we as a whole, you know, work as a whole under this unicameral government? Okay, and made it work? Yeah, we could have. Okay? We could have made it work. Okay. However, certain people are not going to like what's going on. And the national government's inability to respond to the Depression and regional conflicts like Shade Rebellion and things like that are going to compel the states to convene regional conferences to discuss ways to strengthen the nation's economy. So we're going to see in 1786, a convention is going to be held in Annapolis, Maryland. Okay? So from September 11th to the 14th, 1786, they're going to meet. And this convention was called to discuss the economic problems of the time. And, of course, the question of commercial regulations and other issues that were not covered by the Articles of Confederation for the existing United States. So the founders for this meeting, they sent out invitations to all of the states, but attendance was low, okay? They had 12 delegates totally that came to represent 5 states. Okay, so 12 delegates from 5 states come together. Those 5 states were New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia. There's our 5 guys in our 5 states. Okay. So with only 5 states represented, the group is limited to what they could accomplish. Okay? They want to solve the unfortunate economic problems that the country had been experiencing. Trade was slowing down, surplus is rising, you had your lecture on the business cycle, okay? Things aren't selling. They met to discuss what they could do about these problems. Well, during the Annapolis Convention, the attending members decide that their powers that they have are inadequate for their intended purpose. Okay? They argue that any steps that they might be taken with regard to commerce would affect all parts of the government and make necessary a general change to the Articles of Confederation. Okay? Since it's out of the realm of the delegates' power to recommend such changes, they don't have the power to make these changes or to recommend them even. They draft a report, so they write this report and they're going to send it to Congress, calling for another convention to meet in Philadelphia for the spring of 1787. Okay, so in the report, the representatives are going to suggest that these delegates who meet at this new convention in Philadelphia be given wider powers. So this convention meeting here in Annapolis, they unanimously adopt a resolution calling for the special convention in Philadelphia to amend the weak Articles of Confederation and, you know, to work on other serious defects that they found in it. The report gets sent to Congress, And they also sent it to the governors of all of the states. Congress calls for a new convention. This new convention was called for the sole purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation. Okay? Revising the Articles. So that's the idea. Revising, meaning updating, rewriting. It doesn't mean to scrap the whole thing and start over. Okay? But that's what they did. That's what happened. We know that. Okay? Well, the delegates at this convention in Philadelphia, they have permission from Congress to revise the Articles. That's what their task was. Well, 1787, Philadelphia Constitutional Convention. 55 delegates from 12 states, remember I told you at the beginning, Rhode Island is the exception here, okay? They attend the Philadelphia Constitutional Convention in May of 1787. The delegates actually agree to keep the discussions private while this convention, all the proceedings are underway. Because they're concerned that the representatives might not be able to speak freely or be willing to compromise if the details and the debate and all that such is being published or publicized back in their home states. They wouldn't want the delegates to be pressured by their states unduly during this process. Okay. So remember now that part of this lecture is to discuss motivation. Well, why would they dump the whole thing? Why would they dump the Articles of Confederation? Well, it's, you know, we need to kind of think about that. Okay. Remember, the general people, most people were probably happy with the Articles, and we talked about the majority of people kind of going along doing their thing. The Articles weren't a bad thing. They were happy. They were content with their life. Well, using Rhode Island, the exception, okay, as the only state that did not participate, taking a look at this group, their absence is going to create a problem at this convention. The reason why it creates a problem is because in order to amend the Articles of Confederation, it requires a unanimous vote from all the states. No Rhode Island, no unanimous vote. So consequently, the delegates are going to choose to begin writing a new document, which is then going to become the Constitution, as we know. Okay. So what do they do in Philadelphia? They draw an entirely new government. They get rid of this old idea of a unicameral government and they replace it with this bicameral legislature. So we know now they are no longer revising, but they're changing the entire concept. The constitutional authors agree that the main object of government was the preservation of property and the rights of individuals to acquire and hold wealth. This view is going to devalue other functions of government, such as national security and the promotion of the general welfare. However, their perspective reflects the backgrounds of the delegates, who were mostly wealthy landowners. The delegates also found common ground regarding the nature of government. They concluded, once again borrowing from those Enlightenment philosophers, that an effective government had to be balanced. Okay? The power of one entity should offset the power of another to achieve this equilibrium. So doing so is going to require the government to have checks on its own power. So the perspective underlies the concepts of checks and balances and separation of powers within the U.S. government. So we're going to have here power shift from the local government to the national government. Okay, the Articles had emphasized state government and a weak national government, a weak central government. They've been born out of the American Revolution. They stress the anti-tyrannical attitude. So we're going to see change come out of this convention in Philadelphia, and we're going to shift power back to the top. So some of this is going to include things like the power to tax, to coin money, to regulate trade, put down rebellion, things like that. So, now on a side note, okay? People who were noticeably absent from Philadelphia's convention, okay? These are people who were part of the writing of the Articles, but aren't here in Philadelphia. That would be Samuel Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Thomas Paine. Very well-known individuals, purposely absent. Okay? They're not there because they don't like centralized power. Okay? So some are going to be invited. Their responses are going to be similar to Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine's response was, I smell a rat. Okay? The idea being that Paine felt that these men were going to meet and then they were going to abuse their power. So we're going to see that with this new constitution, with this constitution, that there is going to be some restrictions built in. So as a matter of fact, the constitution is not going to be accepted unless there is a Bill of Rights attached. So if you actually analyze the documents, you can see that some of the components of our First 10 Amendments are expressed inherently inside the constitution. And some people will say that the Constitution itself does not go far enough, and the Bill of Rights, as those 10 amendments there, are necessary to secure individual freedoms and rights. Okay? So the Constitution of Bill of Rights, it's going to balance liberty and power. So this is not coincidental. Okay, you should notice that liberty power is also the name of your reading on your CD, LP, not referring to lecture path, but LP meaning liberty and power. And that's what our government is about, balancing liberty and power. Well, the constitutional authors also are going to set up a process for change. Remember, they met, they tried to change the articles, they ran into a little problem. And we're going to change the amount needed to pass the constitutional amendment from unanimity, okay, to two-thirds majority. Okay, they're going to take away state laws, they're going to put in checks and balances. Okay? So they've created this document. It's still with us today. It's intact. Okay? We've made a few additions, granted, okay, in the form of the 27 amendments. Okay, but we essentially, the document itself, the base of it, is the same as it was when they wrote it. Okay? So simply put, the delegates to the Philadelphia Convention, they're going to dump the old articles, and they're going to come up with a new system. So what's the motivation for these founding fathers? Okay. Why did they go to Philadelphia and debate for 4 months, the hot, sticky summer, closed in a room, no air conditioning? Okay. So in a way, we're going to use the model that we have for this class that we've been given as we look at like analyzing people's motivations. Okay. So back up, Pablo Man, Pepsi factors, right? So we can we can analyze the founding fathers' motivation in this way. We're going to do that, not directly. I'm not going to give you PEPS up. We're not going to do that up here, but we'll be talking about some of those things as we go through. So we're going to start with George Bancroft. So as we look at the different historical views, this is our first gentleman here. He was a very famous historian at the turn of the century, last century. Okay. Those of you who are familiar with the library at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, the Bancroft Library, named after this individual. Well, what did he say about motivation about the founding fathers? He says it's patriotism. Okay, that's his feeling. So these guys were noble, altruistic, humble, and kind. Okay, they were led by the sense of greatness for this country. Okay, that they sacrificed their time and money to create a model government for the world. That these guys realized in the famous words of Thomas Paine, okay, these are the times that try men's soul. Okay. They knew that the British were laughing at us and our money system really wasn't worth anything. They knew that for future generations, for mom and apple pie and all that good stuff, that they should write this document, okay? And that's why they came to Pennsylvania. So that's Bancroft, okay? That it was all very patriotic. Okay? We have Washington, we have Franklin. You know, there's no other reason for them to meet than to keep this nation together. Okay. So, you all have your handouts. Yes. Okay. Take a look at the first one. It's a list. The holes are punched on the wrong side. I realize that. Okay. And take a look. The economic interests and political views governed the Constitutional Congress. Pardon. Three columns. For our left-hand side is a list of all the members' names. Second column is their economic interests. Third column, positions, their political positions that they're going to hold. Okay. So we're going to draw some conclusions about the founding fathers based on this information. So if we look at these guys, we need to think about, who are they? Okay. What's their background? Yes, we're going to be making some generalizations. Okay? And some generalizations about their motivation specifically. So the historical question is, why did they write it? Why did they write the Constitution? We're going to form a hypothesis as we look at this. Okay? So now, on the list, we can look at the Founding Fathers' economic and political positions, and we know when we generalize the whole thing, it applies to most, not all, okay? You know the whole deal. Okay, let's think of some generalizations. So I'm going to ask you to do this. I'm going to give you just a moment or two. But I want you to look at the list front and back. Look at the gentlemen on the list. Look at their economic interests. Look at their political interests. And start to think, what are some generalizations you can make about this group of men? Okay? Steer away from the ones that are blatantly obvious, like, you know, they're breathing and they're all men. Okay? That much we know. Okay? Think a little bit more critically about it. Okay? Now you're going to do it in your head, right? So thinking about this list, think about some of the things you know. I have a list up here, and think about how many of your things match my things. Okay? So obviously, of course, the first one up here, I said avoid things like they're all men. You know that. We also know that they were all white men. You can't get that from your list, but we know that. Okay? Many of them were lawyers. Almost 50% of them were. So we know that they know the law. Okay? They're concerned with law and order. 29 of them are college graduates. They're from the upper class. Most of them want some sort of governmental change. Many of them are landowners. Some are even land speculators. There are merchants who had trade interests. 24 of them had mercantile interests. Many of them hold bonds, like securities, state or national debts are owed to them. Okay. 15 of them are slave owners. That reflects them being upper class again. Some of them are against or don't want suffrage. And 24 of them had loaned out money at interest. They were creditors. So basically, we look at this list, we're looking at upper class, merchant, land speculating, slave owning creditors. So by the process of elimination, we can kind of figure out who was not invited to this convention. Possibilization tells us it was our friend Joe Farmer, right? Joe Farmer, servants, slaves, these are the people who are not invited. Okay? So looking at the list, in that room in Philadelphia, all those men present, we can realize it's a fairly elite group that was sitting in. So based on sort of this list, what we just talked about, at the bottom of your paper, on your list there, bottom of your paper, this little, like, one-inch space. What do you think motivated the Founding Fathers? What do you think motivated the Founding Fathers? Write it down. In that one-inch little space, write it down. What do you think motivated the Founding Fathers? Type it. I'm going to give you some time to mention this. What do you think motivated the Founding Fathers? up with. That's sort of what she basically did. She came up with like a hypothesis about the founding fathers' motivation. Okay? Was it things like economics? Was it self-interest? Was it, I mean, there could be any number of tiny things. Something else? Okay? What can we hypothesize about them? Okay? Can we say that the founding fathers were motivated by self-interest? That they wrote the Constitution to protect their self-interest? Okay? Is it possible? Okay? So going through this process of looking at the members of the convention, those delegates, and looking at their background, what their economic and political sort of relations were at the time, we basically duplicated one of the most famous hypotheses in American history. Okay? So let's look at this other story, another story. The economic motivation of the Constitution's founders was the focus of a book written by a progressive, think back to your historiography lecture, right? So progressive philosopher and author Charles Beard, 1913. Okay? Titled An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution. Okay? It's the theory of Charles Beard that the founding fathers were motivated by economic reasons. So Beard characterized the founding fathers as men of great political and social prominence. At the time, 1913, pretty much majority of all intellectuals, thinkers of the time, had read his book. Millions of copies were sold. It changed the view of American history. Okay? So Beard's influence, they have declined over the years, but it's still an important point. So Beard being one of the most famous historians, okay, he was the head of the American Historical Association, the American Political Science Association. He writes with a humanitarian viewpoint. He's trying for social change. Okay? He was a progressive. He looked to Aristotle, Machiavelli, Locke for his ideas. And his hypothesis for the time was very important. Okay? He said that the founding fathers had read Locke. Okay? They knew about life, liberty, and property. Beard says that they wrote the Constitution to protect their property. So as moneylenders and landowners, slave owners, investors, Beard claimed that the founding fathers had much to lose if the nation failed. So Beard theorized that the Constitution was developed to keep the wealthy in power and increase their material wealth. They maintained that they would secure power of the executive branch through the Electoral College. The legislature, through the selection of the Senate by the state legislatures, and the judicial branch through executive appointment and Senate confirmations. Okay? So based on Beard, were the founding fathers really interested in democracy? Okay? If we look at some of them, we can see their views. Eldridge Gerry, he said, the evils we experience flow from the excesses of democracy. Okay? Edmund Randolph, he talks about follies of democracy. Hamilton, he said that society is divided naturally into rich and poor. Edmund Morris, he wanted to set up an aristocracy of property. Well, were these people really concerned with giving the right to vote to everyone? Okay? Now, James Madison, even, he talks about securing private rights against majority factions and urged for property qualifications for voters. Beard did just what we do. He looked at the background of these men, and he said that the Articles hurt a lot of them. They own securities, they're in shipping and manufacturing, and they're not making out well with the new government. And he'll say that these are the people who pushed for a new government. Okay? So what's he going to call these people? Well, he's going to call them the Federalists. Okay? The Federalists are the rich people who are not gaining things. Who opposes the Constitution? Well, they're going to be the anti-Federalists, who like things the way they are. Okay? They're the poor, they're from places like Rhode Island. Okay? Beard feels that property people were being kept out of the convention. Was he right? Well, yeah, we looked at the list, yes, they were. Okay? Those poor farmers, the servants, the slaves, those were people who were kept out. Okay? This means that the members of the convention got strong personal benefit from the Constitution. Okay? We can say that, in essence, the Constitution was an economic document drawn up with superb skill by men whose economic interests were at stake. So, Beard looked at the new government. It had some strong economic powers. It had the power to tax, as well as the power to set up tariff. extradition as a result of things like Shane's Rebellion, okay? Federal government regulating paper money. States can no longer impair contracts to stop bankruptcy proceedings, okay? You can't have sting laws anymore. Bear says that this is protecting the upper middle class, okay? He then looked at ratification. He said it was pretty much the same. The rich people wanted to ratify and the poor people did not. He said that ratification was set up to succeed. That the article said, under the Articles of Confederation, in order to change it, in order to make some ratification to it, you needed to have unanimity, right? In this document, with the Constitution, it's only two-thirds. 13 states, what's two-thirds? That's 9 states, okay? So, essentially what he's saying is that those 9 states, they're going to bypass Rhode Island, New Jersey, New Hampshire. What do those have in common? They're small states. Okay. The ratification is going to take place not in legislature, okay, because that might be largely radical, okay, but in conventions. And who dominates these conventions when they hold them? Well, that would be, of course, the upper class. Here's so that you set up a strong government that protects property, it advances commerce. It's a rich man's conspiracy. So how many of you would accept Deard's hypothesis? Raise your hands. How many of you would accept Deard's hypothesis? Okay. Deard's argument is later going to be challenged by Jackson Maine. It's going to be attacked by Forrest McDonald, who we'll talk about, Robert Brown, John Roach. But his theory did compel others to note the nature of representation at the Continental Convention. Common farmers, craftsmen, other middle-class citizens were not among the delegates. So, let's take a look at the other handout that you got when you came in. Chart here. Let's take a quick look at North Carolina's ratification. So this is one page from a several hundred page book in which the gentleman Forrest McDonald examined the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists at the state and local level. We can see that perhaps Beer overgeneralized the position of the Founding Fathers. He did have a good foundation, but we need to look deeper. So McDonald looks at North Carolina, which was the 12th state to ratify. Okay? They were a bit slow. Okay? He looks at this from the standpoint that North Carolina had two conventions. Okay? For the first convention, they voted no against the Constitution. And in the second convention, they did vote yes, but really, I mean, they're the 12th state. They're